This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Melinda Merk, is a pioneer of forensic veterinary medicine. She conducts autopsies and examines evidence to determine the cause of death in animals when foul play is suspected. She lives and works in Georgia, where a law was passed in 2000 making it a felony to assault an animal. Prior to the passage of that law, she founded a cat clinic, and she also worked on cruelty cases with local animal control agencies. In 2003, she joined Georgia Legal Professionals for Animals as the Vice President of Veterinary and Forensic Affairs. She's now the forensic vet for the ASPCA. She's the author of a guide for vets and police on animal cruelty cases. In June, her new book, Veterinary Forensics, will be published. Because Dr. Merk will be discussing her approach to investigating sometimes gruesome attacks on animals, we don't think this interview would be appropriate for young children. Some adults may find it disturbing, too. Dr. Merk, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you find that some people, including some police, some lawyers, and judges, consider crimes against animals to be relatively unimportant?
I think that in the past that has been more of the norm. I have seen in the last 2 to 3 years a change in that. And I think that what is responsible for that is that the education that is going on through the ASPCA and other organizations about the link with animal cruelty and other acts of violence. Specifically, oftentimes these cases, the defendants in these cases also have either outstanding warrants or they have criminal backgrounds or there's concurrent crimes going on, such as drugs and domestic violence. So I think that has caused a shift in the focus and taking these cases seriously and giving them proper investigations and support as far as prosecution as well.
A few years ago, Georgia made it a felony, made cruelty to animals a felony. So how has that affected the legal system? I mean, what are cruelty to animal trials like? Do they proceed any differently than trials about crimes committed against people?
I think that initially when the law was passed, it took a couple of years, and I think that happens in most states, for everybody to catch up to understand that there was a new law and what it meant. And we have seen a huge shift in taking these cases seriously, especially with law enforcement. They have really caught on to this linking with other acts of violence. So, yes, I think they are taking them more seriously. I just recently spoke to a prosecutor on a case that I'm on here in the local area, and he's treating it equally with his other cases that he has, and this is at the felony level. So they are committing resources, both through investigation and prosecutors, to take these cases to court.
How many states in the country now have cruelty to animal laws?
I believe we're at 47 that at least have some type of animal cruelty law on their books, and a majority have felony laws as well.
My guest is forensic veterinarian Dr. Melinda Merk. I had mentioned that she investigates some gruesome cases. We're about to discuss one, and I want to remind you that what we're about to hear is not appropriate for young children. Some adults may find it upsetting, too. One of the cases you were involved in involved a puppy who was baked to death in an oven by two teenage boys who had broken into a community center. And in addition to charges against them of aggravated cruelty to animals, they were charged with burglary, criminal damage to property, making terrorist threats, and cruelty to children. So what did you learn about how the puppy was killed?
Well, the evidence showed that the puppy was killed, ultimately killed, but not after suffering several acts of torture. She had been hogtied with duct tape and then muzzled with duct tape, and then they had poured paint on her and then tried to set her on fire. And when that didn't work, it seems like that was the mentality. When that didn't work, then they turned on the oven and placed her in the oven. And then they went and had some local children brought them in to witness her in the oven. What I also found at the crime scene was evidence that the puppy had been running around in the community center prior to that. There was urine that we later submitted for DNA testing to confirm it was the puppy's urine that she had been running around, probably while they were destroying the community center. And then somewhere along those lines is when they decided to commit their cruelty against her. So what it really told me is the sequence of events, and which became important later in the case with eyewitness testimony, the children coming in, the timelines became a factor. And it's always tough when you have a case that involving children because they can be easily impeached on the witness stand. The defense can try to get them to change their stories. The terroristic threats charges came because the defendants had threatened the children if they told anybody.
And the cruelty to children charges came because they brought the children to witness the destruction of the dog.
Correct.
So you actually had a puppy with you on the stand when you're giving your testimony. What did you do with the puppy?
Well, the purpose of bringing in the puppy, one of the questions that came up or one of the changes in the defendant's statements is they started to say that one of the two young men had done it and the other one hadn't. He was just watching. So what we wanted to prove was that it is very difficult for one person to have hogtied her with the tape. And this comes in with the natural veterinary experience. It's why we have veterinary assistants. When we go to restrain an animal, we usually need some assistance to do something. Puppies and kittens are harder to restrain than an adult dog or an adult cat. And what I said is that if they hogtied her first, which is what I believe that they did, she would have immediately started biting. And she would have been struggling. As soon as you grab two legs, she would have been struggling. So what we did with Rita, that was the name of the puppy in court, is we demonstrated that using non-tape but some other kind of material to show what a puppy's natural reaction is, to show that it would have taken two people and not likely that it was one defendant.
So you also proved through forensic evidence that the puppy was actually baked to death as opposed to being dead before the puppy was put in the oven. Why was that important in the case, and how did you prove it?
One defense that we were trying to anticipate is that they could say that they found a deceased animal on the side of the road and then put it in the oven. So it was important to show that that she had been alive in order to actually charge them with a felony cruelty. So what I found in the oven was the paint that was still wet on her had been smeared all over in the oven, corresponding to respective body parts, meaning her head and her tail. And that is what showed us that she was alive when she went in the oven.
The boys who killed this puppy also broke into a community center, destroyed some things within the community center, threw paint on the walls. They were going to be, it found out, they were going to be prosecuted regardless of whether they had hurt an animal. But how do you think the fact that you were able to show that they tortured and then killed an animal affected how they were sentenced?
I think the fact that there was a severe, heinous act of animal cruelty in conjunction with the criminal damage and the burglary, that went more to the psyche of the defendants and the heinousness of the act spoke volumes of their risk, their future risk to the public of future acts of violence. I think that made it more than just a case about burglary and criminal damage to property, though that was extremely disheartening for that area. This was a low-income area, and that community center represented hope for those children. It was beautiful. It had a library and computers. But what really spoke to the depths of depravity of this act was the animal cruelty.
So the two teenagers who were responsible for torturing and killing the puppy and for breaking into the community center, what was their sentence?
They received 20 years for the burglary charge. The total was 20 years. What they received was the maximum on each count, each of the 9 counts that they pled guilty to. And the animal cruelty, the most they can get is 5 years. So what they got was 20 years to serve 10 years in prison and 10 years probation, and everything was lumped together to serve concurrently.
Would you consider this a very unusual case for you?
It is the worst case that I have ever seen or heard of. People that have been working with animal cruelty for 20-plus years agree that this is the worst case that they had ever seen.
What's your typical case like, if there is such a thing?
The most common case that anybody sees is neglect, and that can vary from an animal suffering from malnutrition in the backyard and starving. But the majority of the cases that we're starting to see more and more of, and I think that these are extremely heinous as well, is the large-scale animal neglect cases. And those involve hoarders, which is the collection of animals. It involves puppy mills. And then, of course, the other large-scale cases are dogfighting.
Now, you mentioned that the collection of animals is one of the common forms of abuse that you find. You were on one case where there were 130 dead cats found in one large house, along with 26 severely malnourished cats. What was your role in this case?
It was a long night. I did the crime scene investigation. There was there was three floors, and every floor there was deceased cats in various stages of decomposition. And then we had the 26 live cats. So the prosecutor, Laura Jansen, came out on the scene, and I pretty much examined every animal that I could, and we started collecting evidence. And there was a lot of
You were examining the living animals or the dead animals?
I started examining the deceased animals mm-hmm. as best as I could at the scene. Most of them were too decomposed to do a proper necropsy, but what there was a lot of insect evidence. And I use forensic entomology, which is the study of insects in legal cases, to establish time of death. And that became very important in this case because neglect typically is charged as a misdemeanor. And because of the massive amount of animals that had died, what we were trying to do was find a way to charge this as a felony. So what we used in this case was the time of death, which we backdated to approximately the end of October the previous year. And then during our search of the home, we found paperwork to show that she had obtained more cats after all those 130 cats were dead. In our laws, we have to prove knowingly and maliciously as far as intent. And so the district attorney felt that that was enough to charge her with a felony.
So how do you use insects in forensic analysis of tortured or killed animals?
I use insects to determine the time of death or the time of injury. Sometimes there are the fly larvae, which are maggots. They are present on a live animal that has been injured, and that'll tell me how long ago the animal was injured, and they also are used to determine time of death.
What was her story? Like, why was she collecting so many cats and then either killing or allowing them to die?
Well, the necropsy on the ones that I could do showed that they had died of starvation. The mentality behind hoarding is complicated. There's several studies and ongoing research that's done on them. Traditionally, the typical hoarder has supposedly good intentions at the beginning, and then there's some trigger in their life, a death of a loved one, a loss of a job, some kind of severe stressor in their life that then flips a switch, so to speak, and they start neglecting their animals. I believe that there's some subcategories in some of the cases that I've seen, not particularly in this one, where there may be some element of some kind of Munchausen by proxy, where they're trying to get attention by taking some of the animals to the vet. And then some of them, I don't believe that they fall under the hoarding category at all. I feel that they're truly just sadistic killers of animals. There was a case just recently, once again in Ohio, where a woman confessed that she had been drowning puppies and kittens, or puppies and cats and dogs, over, I'm not even sure the time period, but up to 650 animals. And I'm like, that's not a hoarder. There's something else going on there.
What is one of the mysteries that you helped solve that you're most proud of?
Recently, I think the assistance on a case that I had recently is the one that I was the most happy with, that we got a conviction as well. Of course, the outcome was good. This was a case where a man had shot his neighbor's dog. And there was a lot of problems with the case. He had a history of shooting a black lab puppy when he was on his riding lawnmower trying to claim self-defense. And this was, of course, several years ago, and he actually was acquitted. So he had this history in this neighborhood of shooting animals, not liking animals. And the neighbor who lived behind him had a standard poodle, female. Those are very friendly dogs. The dog somehow got out between their fences and into his yard. The owner immediately went running around to get the dog, and she heard the dog yelp and heard the gunshot. Now, no one saw who shot the dog. All we knew is where the dog was when she was shot in his yard. So the problem was the defendant claimed that he didn't shoot the dog. He didn't claim self-defense. He just claimed that he flat out didn't shoot the dog. So we had a problem, and she was shot with an air rifle and was fatally wounded and died later that day. So what I brought to the table with the prosecutor was that because it was an air gun and an air rifle, it's not a very loud firearm. So the fact that she heard the shot placed her in close proximity to where the gunshot was fired. So what I decided, I said, why don't we go to the neighborhood and take some pictures and do some trajectories and determine where the areas the shot could have been fired from. And so what we did in that surrounding area is interviewed all the neighbors, found out, and they all testified on the stand that none of them owned that kind of firearm. And we were able to show that there was only one other yard that shot could have come from, and he had an alibi. And all the neighbors also owned pets except for the defendant. And the judge accepted our circumstantial evidence. We did a diagram and everything, and I testified there was one specific piece of evidence that the dog, where she ran to in the yard, was abnormal as far as behavior when injured or fearful. She ran away from her mom. And that was supportive of where he was standing when he shot the dog, because in order for the dog to have come to the mother, she would have had to got closer to him. So that was also a behavioral confirmation that he shot the dog.
What was his sentence?
He was sentenced to 1 year. Well, it was charged as a misdemeanor, so the maximum we could get was 1 year.
When you started doing forensic veterinary work after years of just being, a regular veterinarian, there wasn't a lot that was written about animal forensics. So I know that you studied human forensics and went to human autopsies to try to get your bearings with animal forensics. What are some of the things that, transferred quite nicely between human and animal forensics, and others that really didn't at all, things that are really unique to animal forensics that you're not going to learn by studying human forensics?
I think that the main thing that does not transfer from human forensics to animals is bruising. Animals do not bruise like humans. And if they do bruise, it can take hours to show up. And so that can be a barrier also with law enforcement and investigation of these cases, because if they can't see the bruising, then they don't really understand how that there was blunt force trauma. Of course, we have some different kinds of injury that we're not going to see in humans, like embedded collars that grow into the skin of animals. And we have certainly different kinds of infections that occur in animals. And so there's enough unique identifiers of animals that do separate it out from the human forensic side.
Now, when you mentioned that animals don't bruise, is it just that we don't see their bruises because they're covered by fur, or do they really not bruise?
They really rarely bruise. There are certain areas that do bruise, and certainly if their skin is lighter, their fur color is lighter, they're more susceptible to showing a bruise. But their bruising is under the skin, and their skin is so thick, they don't have as big of a vascular supply, blood vessels to their skin, which is really their makeup because of getting into fights, running through woods and so forth. They aren't made to bleed very easily from their skin. And so that's why we don't see the bruising.
How many animals do you have?
I have 2 dogs and 15 cats.
But you're not a hoarder, right?
That's right. Well, we should define hoarding as those that have more animals than they can take care of. No, most of mine have been rescued, neglected, abandoned, and I have a very large home that can accommodate them.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Melinda Merck works in Georgia, where she's the forensic veterinarian for the ASPCA and consultant for the Fulton County District Attorney's Office in Atlanta. Her book, Veterinary Forensics, will be published in June.